The Right to Question is supported in part by the Paul Allen Family Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
Are these poems autobiographical?
Very much so. I would have to admit that, yeah. A lot of them I wrote after my father died in 2008, and that was kind of the impetus that made me have the idea of putting them together in a collection. They're kind of based on personal experience, but what I try to find is the truth of the emotion that's expressed in the poem. That's kind of my goal, is to communicate the feeling behind it.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program all about writers from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman. Zan Bacchus is my guest this time, and we're talking about her new collection of poems titled Caught in Passing. There's one poem called My Father Teaches Me to Fly, and obviously you've carried that moment with you for all of these years. How do you think that affected your adult life, just that one moment in time?
Oh, it's kind of a psychological twister, you know, a thing to say. He says at the end, you didn't try hard enough. And that has so many different implications, I think. You know, in a way it's humorous because it's kind of a ridiculous thing to say, but then it's also very sobering in that, you know, no matter how hard you try, you're not going to fly.
And I just wondered if that translated into other things. So you tried really hard to do things in your life and you failed. And do you think that set you up in any way?
I don't know if it set me up, but it made me pay attention to that more, I think.
Can we hear that poem?
Sure. My father teaches me to fly. I am old enough to know it is not possible, but the wind rushing in from the lake lifts my hair, brushes my face like a wing. I feel like I could fly, I say. He grins. Anything is possible, he says. He says it's windy enough to fly across the lake. He drapes a towel over my bare shoulders, tells me to flap it like this, and he spreads his great arms out like an eagle, his fingers extended like the wingtips of hawks. I know if I run fast enough down the dock, I can fly out to the mooring post. His eyes believe in me. I suck in air, flap my wings, and know that I can fly. From the beach to the end of the dock is a 40-foot runway. My father gives me the starting sign, and I tear down the dock straight into the full wind, legs pumping, wind snapping my terry cloth wings. I see the gray lake ahead, and I'm off the end, flapping, struggling, willing the wind to pick me up, and I think maybe I fly a few feet, but the cold lake crashes in my ears. When I come up, my father stands on shore, shaking his head, and the towel weighs me down. He says only one thing, you didn't try hard enough.
I have to say that last line just really got me, because it seemed like such an awful thing to say to a child. And your poetry also has other scenes where your father is essentially cruel to you. You didn't write these poems until after the end of his life. How did that process of writing help you move through some of your feelings?
Yeah, I believe it did. Yeah. Just writing them was a process of grieving and recovering and healing from grief. And we had a very complicated, complex relationship. There was cruelty, but at the same time, there was an immense love that I unfortunately didn't really feel until the very end. But the healing that went on when I was with him when he died was amazing, and it helped me work through the emotions in some of these poems.
Had you been writing poetry all of your life?
Yeah, I've been writing since I was like 5 years old. Very early on, I had the idea that somewhere in my adult life, I'd be working with words in some form or other. And that was my chief form of communication, actually.
Well, the poems that I enjoy the most are the ones that create kind of fragile images. They're images that you really almost can't explain and you can't hold on to. And one of those poems was the first one in the book, Meditation on Dust.
Uh-huh.
So I'd like you to read that, and then we'll talk about what it means, if we can. I couldn't quite think of a way to grab onto it, so maybe we'll be able to after we hear it.
Yeah, maybe. Meditation on Dust. I begin by breathing. Soft and gray, the room hangs within the pane-framed sky. I erase the traces of the day, the minutes sifted across the ledge by the tireless ebb of time, trailing the uncut thread, life beyond measure. Here and now, I glide among the relics, treasure these heartbeats rising inside my ribs, the moments they mark, singular and together in shifting light. I breathe my being into the silver motes, world so open, I find myself suspended, moving as they must through the dust of my remains.
So tell me about that poem.
Well, actually, I wrote this poem for another collection that I was doing on cleaning houses. I wrote a series of poems about some of my experiences doing my job, which is cleaning houses. I call myself a residential sanitation specialist.
Ooh, fancy. Okay, so when I read it, I had the idea that you were putting life into dust, that you were imbuing pieces of dust with a life thread that goes through everything.
Right.
And I think we tend to think of dust as just this dead thing.
Yeah.
But not in your poem.
Right. It might be sort of a defense against, you know, the death implicated by dust. The motivation to put life into something in order to bear it more easily, maybe.
One of the things that you said when we had an email exchange is that you have been diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And I was wondering how that might have affected your writing.
Well, it certainly gave me a lot to write about. I've had some very unusual experiences, and I think it's possible that that my experiences kind of forced me to write as a way of dealing with, you know, some of the things I've been through.
Mm-hmm. Is there one particular poem in this collection that exemplifies that?
There aren't many poems in this collection that deal directly with mental illness or bipolar disorder, but there is one that kind of mentions it briefly.
The one where your father is saying it?
Right, mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, let's hear that one.
Okay. Last poem from my father. Daughter, my body hurts. This soul so tight against the inside of my skin needs release. A thing grows within me, part of me, yet not. The cancer of all my rage and regrets gnaws at the cage of my bones. Pain gusts across the wires of my muscles in tuneless chords. No music, no choirs, no angels and harps, only the monotonous drumbeat of this tired heart. While you flailed in the ceaseless maelstrom of your disease, my daughter, you were the one I could not save. You told me of voices inside you, their insistent mechanical rasping, how they made you shiver. Born on the wind of their whispers, you sailed away and never saw me waving, calling, come back, daughter, come back. Yet here you are now, fully yourself, by my bed with your red hat and green eyes, your grin fearless in the face of my somber awakening. Life removes, expands, compresses, relaxes, like the tides that govern us. Across the ceiling of this room stretches a horizon I approach with each breath, and as the sails begin to fill, I see you waving, too.
There are several poems in the collection where you and your father are sailing, and I think you are from is it Nebraska?
Nebraska, right. Yeah. Omaha.
And so there must have been a lake close to where you live.
My grandmother lived up on Lake Okoboji, which is a fairly large lake for Iowa. It's a large lake in the northwestern corner.
And you had a poem in there, the Pleiades of Lake
Okoboji, yeah.
And I also had that one as marked as one that I'd like you to read, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Is this a true story?
Yeah, it is. It is. There's a story about seven women that drowned altogether, much the same way this poem goes.
Wow.
The Pleiades of Lake Okoboji. Hand in hand, seven girls pick their way along the arm of rocks on Pillsbury Point, the hot July wind, an insistent child tugging at their skirts. Their grasp join them for life like a mother's touch, a solid, warm, a permanent thing. Their mothers wait up late in Orange City, knitting in the dim circles of lamps. One foot slipping on the seaweed's green hair, one leg pulled down by Okoboji's hungry fist, and the undertow swallowing, claimed the first, who hung on to the second, who clung to the third, who clasped the fourth's damp fingers, who pulled the fifth down, who screamed the sixth, who toppled, grabbing the last, who fell, not knowing the first had ever fallen. Years and waves wash over the rocks. When Okoboji lies quiet and dark, we see them, hands still joined, faces upturned and reflected, seven stars in the black belt of heaven.
You've been listening to Zan Bacchus read from her collection of poems titled Caught in Passing. This is The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman. We'll be back right after a short break to continue our conversation and to hear more poems. Stay with us, and be sure to check out our blog at mtpr.org/twq. Does bipolar occur strictly because of brain chemistry, or does it have something to do with experiences?
That's a really heavy question. That's just like, that's a big debate, actually. I think part of it is certainly biochemical, but I think there are also experiences that you have when you grow up that either enhance it or tone it down. And so it's kind of a nature versus nurture type thing. For me personally, I found that there's definitely a big biochemical component. But the experiences that I've had have made me more susceptible to perhaps having it more severely.
Was it worse when you were younger?
Yeah, it was. It was actually most of my 20s and 30s. It was... I would have probably five or six episodes a year, and each episode would last 2 weeks to a month, where I'd be experiencing symptoms or recovering in the hospital or getting sick again.
So that was pretty debilitating just for your everyday life.
It was,
Would have been hard to have a job.
Yeah.
Hmm.
I wasn't able to work.
Or sustain any kinds of relationships.
Yeah.
Hmm. When I read Where Memory Begins, I wondered if this is where it started. And I'd like you to read that, and let's just think about that question.
Sure. Where Memory Begins. My home is the slapping of screen doors, the long, low voice my mother's call, plaintive and distant. In my home, we cut words from silhouettes of memory. We speak the language of blood and bone, the crack of skin and fist, the rasp of shouts, crash of glass. My house rocks with the explosions of discussions. No one is ever right. My father's face is a large leather boot, toe-nosed, laced with fire, a kick and a stomp. My mother's face, a white dinner plate, says flatly, "If you can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all." Children are to be seen and not heard, so alone we cry, and alone we shake with untethered fury. The windows sag open, the doors snap shut, the telephone never rings. Home is the lies we believe, the promises we forget, the hopes we swallow with the hungry drains of our mouths. At home we eat leftovers, but never the meal they are left over from. Skeletal dust of newts and mice settle under the bureau, found much too late. Death is easy, expected, and vaguely pleasant to think about. It is never explained. In the checkered shade of a garden lattice, we pretend to cultivate what we know. My home is the secret and unforgiven tourniquet around the heart. I take what I can get. I bear away the white lies and the little questions, the answers hung out to dry on the line of my mother's mouth. Home is a place I run from, away from brittle lives, from the mangle and tangle of tender flowers as they give birth to violent shades. In our home, the greatest fear is of love itself, how it runs beneath the skin.
When I saw at the beginning of the book on the dedication page that you wrote, quote, "In honor of my mother and father who still give me courage," where is this courage coming from and how does it manifest?
Well, I think the courage came in actually writing these things down and having other people read them, and also facing my own anger and my own sorrow that it took to write these poems was an act of courage.
Do other people tell you that they've had similar experiences and that they understand what you're writing?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've heard that a lot. It's kind of curious, but it seems like there's many people that have come up to me and said that such and such was their favorite poem, and I'm always astonished at how various it is.
Probably based on some kind of a reflection they see of their own experience.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. I'm really happy to have it come out of the closet. Very excited about it being published. I think it's because I believe I'm finally making the leap from unknown to obscure.
Well, I noticed that you thanked a lot of people for helping you get these poems out into the world. And sometimes we think of writing as being something that's very solitary, but it really isn't, is it?
Oh, it really isn't, yeah. There's a lot of people that have helped me in some way or another. My father and my mother, probably the most.
Your poem, What's Left, contains this sentence: "My gentle father, how your whipping hands stung." And the words gentle and whipping hands seem really incompatible, which is what made the poem so interesting and thought-provoking.
Mm-hmm.
Can you think of how those two things fit together in your mind?
Again, just the juxtaposition between the anger and sorrow and grief versus doing what we can to survive those things. It shows the two faces of my dad. He was abusive, physically abusive at some points, but he was also incredibly loving.
And things look different at the end of a person's life.
Right, right, very much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a series of poems that you have in here that are about the death of your mother and the death of your father. And I thought they were especially poignant. And if you wouldn't mind reading that series, I think it's four or five poems.
Sure.
I'd like to hear them.
Reliving the death of my mother. You are driving the flat expanse of Nebraska, glancing at each mile marker leading you home. Somehow the sky seems more open, like a wide blue funnel sucking birds into flight, blowing soft air on the melting snow. It is warm for January. Your trip is almost over. My father lies next to you, reclined in the velvet seat, breath heavy as a wet rag. He has driven all night, and you take the wheel lightly in your fingers for the last leg. The sun on snow, the two-lane leading forever through brown fields, bright sky pouring through your windshield, birds rising from waving grasses, all conspire to make you dream. Behind your eyes, a circus happens. You hear the laughter, the groans of a sideshow freak, a man with a tail, calliopes and screams, someone shouting, "Step right up!" All you know then is the burst of a giant balloon, the air rushing out to slam your chest. Darkness, darkness. And the next one's called Point of Departure. My father and I drive without speaking. All around us, Nebraska rolls her fields by, the barns and farmhouses pinned to the skirt of her reckoning. The sun pounds our windshield, glances off metal and white clapboard. Outside Geneva, on the two-lane running south, we look for the scene of the accident, our eyes weary. "Right here," my father says. "When I came to, I saw this tree, bare and bright with melting ice. Your mother never opened her eyes." We stand on the shoulder, and I search for her in the corn, try to see what she must have seen just before. The blue sky shouts that moment, the impact, the sudden shift. A bird flies south, winging quick circles, startled from its nest. And this is called Waking to the Dream. When my father woke, this tree was bare and bright with melting ice, branches cased in a glass coffin. Did my mother see this tree as she died, or was she dreaming? A year later, my father and I have come to relive the shout of that moment, how the sudden shift rippled through the last journey, the hurtling car, no one to forgive or blame. This is the place, the two-lane leading north to Geneva, losing its bearings on the sharp curve, its shoulders soft from a late January thaw. Nebraska's fields open wide beside the highway, rows of withered corn a suggestion of dormancy, their brown husks shivering in cold sun like a tired army. Did my mother wake as she died? Did she catch a last glimpse of my father dozing in the passenger seat? Or did her own dream continue past the breaking point, when one life was exchanged for another, sleep exchanged for waking? The tree, frozen in its silver shroud, still stands as witness to ends and beginnings and the dream we live in between. Widower. She's gone, and winter light freezes on the pane, feathers of frost in her likeness, red and yellow spots cutting my sight in this razor anguish. At night, I dream of her flashing past in the fur of a gorgeous animal, blue and silver hairs streaming, the afterwards trace of colors and skies, my backward glance as she passes and disappears. Against the pain of waking, I close my eyes to this morning's disguise of promise, its vice pressing close. "She's gone," says her chair of empty sun. "Gone," ticks the clock on the silent piano. "She's gone, and candles sit unlit in tarnished holders. Every time before is the last of this, of that. The circle of circumstance cinches tight. Beyond the window, day begins, and I shiver in its punishing light.
In the last poem in that series that I'd like you to read, you weave in the Lord's Prayer into the stanzas of the poem.
Right. Our Father, when He stares down, we cower from the light. Darkness is a place we live in, a windowless home we've grown attached to. With its dust and lostness, this is our Father's house, who art in heaven, where a once familiar room becomes a simple box, a collection of bones, the keen of grief. We look for another story, another music, another open door. Hallowed be thy name. He is Dad, Father, Box, Leadfoot, Tom, Mr. Bacchus, and Bacchus, the appellations now stones in the mouths of those who miss him. Thy kingdom come. When death bawled his name, he fell to the wooden floor, the dry hunting fields, where we once flushed pheasants from rows of corn. Thy will be done. My brother and I can never escape the sting of the ruler, the failure to measure what we know, on earth as it is in heaven. Its remains interred above those who have gone before, and wind rattles the scattered leaves around the yawning hole. Give us this day our daily bread. Every night of our youth, he returned from artificial light to find us hiding, sorry for what we didn't know we did. And forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Regret, no longer an aspiration, as the winds tunnel through his lips, our plea a jewel of cherished dreams, set in the ring of our pain, the words unspoken in eerie steam, the storm wrinkled by heat lightning. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. In death he offers safety, in life a need to atone, in between a limbo of good intentions. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory. He leaves us then with honor, a sum of wonder, and an empty pocket of promises. With his large life, he towers, but cannot stop sinking. Forever and ever, past our grasping hands, where the endless syllables of his struggling song repeat every distant wish. His hospital room echoes with the clicking of yellow pills in paper cups, the hiss of the breathing machine. His last words stick in his collapsing throat, and sleep begins, a drifting into silent prayer. Amen.
Zan Bacchus lives in Missoula, Montana. There's more about her and her poetry at our blog, which you'll find at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a week full of good reading and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Ostein, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.